It's February 23rd, 2012. This is the Hell Yeah Show. Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Emery.
And we are bringing you best practices for fine living, advice on how to not let technology ruin your day.
That's the truck backing up.
Yeah, I'm going to say it today. Our theme today is back it up. This show is going to be mainly about backups, mostly because Emery had the chance earlier this week to talk to the, the writer of Arc.
He's the head guy. He's the developer of a really cool backup software for OS X. And we talk a little bit about, well, we'll talk about that later. It was a really good interview. I really had a good time doing it.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to hearing that later in the show. For the time being, though, we've got some non-backup related topics to talk about. Emery, what's been going on in your world this week?
Well, I mean,
you know, the world of cell phone carriers, which is clearly the one that you inhabit.
Yeah. The big news this week in that arena is T-Mobile getting huge, tall stacks of cash and some wireless spectrum from AT&T.
Which is kind of funny, since the whole purpose of this deal was AT&T looking for more wireless spectrum because they said they didn't have enough.
AT&T could not spare a square.
Yeah.
So, I thought that was an interesting twist, yeah.
So this was basically when they entered into this arrangement where, ideally for them, they would eventually merge into one cell carrier. AT&T promised T-Mobile, basically, if this doesn't work out, we'll give you a bunch of money.
It didn't work out. And so T-Mobile got, what was it, $3 billion and some more spectrum, which they promptly parlayed into plans to deploy like a 4G network, which is good for consumers.
Wow. Yeah.
Some good competition there. The downside is that AT&T is still left holding a bag. Not only are they out $3 billion, but now they're also going to be missing some spectrum, which I guess it's not like it's not stuff they were really going to be needing or relying on too heavily in the future. Just the frequency bands that they're talking about weren't their usual thing. But the really interesting story here, though, is that T-Mobile is able to take this influx and do something with it. Now, I've kind of mixed feelings on that because first of all, the whole notion of AT&T like buying someone up like this specifically to do this is kind of ridiculous when the real problem wouldn't necessarily be solved. So, I mean, it would be one thing if you were buying T-Mobile and then you were able to like kick all of the T-Mobile customers off that network, you know. But that's not what they were talking about. I mean, they're also going to take that business. So,
right.
You know, what are you going to do with that? Like, I don't know. I think AT&T in particular benefits from, I mean, who are they really competing? I mean, they have Verizon and they have Sprint and then like a bunch of regional and the MVNOs that are being kicked out. So it's, I don't really think that AT&T has a lot of heat on them right now, really. I mean, Verizon and AT&T are the two biggest operators. I mean, Sprint and T-Mobile and then the regionals are, you know, kind of trailing there. But it hasn't really influenced any of them to compete price-wise. I mean, they're all essentially running the same racket and they still have like the same...
I mean, yes, you know, there are differences in the way they price out their plans. But at the end of the day,
you're essentially paying the same thing no matter where you go. Like none of them are any cheaper than the other except for like, you know, some of the prepay or regional packages.
Right.
So... And then, like, the MVMOs, like, you know, Ting gets to compete on price in a way that, you know, these guys can't. So there's certainly some interesting things that could happen there, but we haven't seen it yet. And I don't think that picking up T-Mobile and making them go away was going to make anything better for us.
Yeah, yep.
I mean, we still have the same problem where AT&T still does weird things with, like, their text messaging plans, and there's all sorts of shenanigans there, but... I don't know.
Yeah. Well, T-Mobile's a little better off now, which I think is not a bad thing because they've been the underdog in the cell phone in the major carriers. Among the major carriers, they've been the underdog.
In the United States, right? Like
in the United States.
They're a global operator. Like,
yeah. T-Mobile, we're talking about T-Mobile US. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, and it's just like, Verizon's had I don't know if they still have that or not, but, Vodafone. Vodafone like the big stakeholder there? So there's some of that there. And I don't know. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's interesting to watch. I don't know the what's going to pan out from it, but T-Mobile and AT&T are the two big GSM operators. Then you have Sprint and Verizon that are both on CDMA, and to a lesser extent, iDEN. Like Sprint has that iDEN network still, I think. But that's like all on some low spectrum, so maybe they're like recycling that or something. I don't know. But yeah, it's been... That's an interesting story, but most of my energy this week was focused on reading about Mountain Lion stuff on Macintosh and raging about it.
Yeah, this is. I was telling you before the show, you have complained to me several times about people on Macintosh being stupid about things, and
I get so pissed off reading that website.
I think you need to find a new Mac-related, or maybe none. You just need to stop reading about people talking about OS 10 on the internet.
I don't understand this iCloud thing. Why are people so eager to give all their information? That, and then there's this guy that runs like a blog from, I don't even want to tell you the name of it, but I'll link it to you privately. But
no free publicity here. Yeah.
No, this guy's a total asshat. He runs this website, and I think he's a British guy, but he lives in like Slovenia somewhere. And he has like this really stupid article up about how Apple is spying on people and harvesting their personal data. And like he cites, you heard of this software called Little Snitch?
Sure. Yeah.
This is the most idiotic piece of software on the planet because everyone that installs it thinks that they're like Columbo. Because every time, like, in this guy's case, it's Aperture.
Yeah.
That talks to the Apple update server.
Well, and it's like, so basically we should explain what Little Snitch does first, right? So
yeah, we should, because nobody knows, especially this guy, because what Little Snitch does is it just watches to see things that are like, leaving your computer. And if when a connection is trying to be made out, it will say, hey, did you know that so-and-so is trying to open up a port and go to this, this host on this port? And then it doesn't tell you anything other than that.
Sure.
But this guy sees the message saying that Aperture is talking to Apple to see if there's a software update. And this tells him that Apple is harvesting his address book and stealing all of his data. Like, this guy, Johnny Columbo, is absolutely certain that Apple, like, there is not a tinfoil hat big enough for this guy. And it pisses me off because the software like Little Snitch could be really useful, except that, like, the only people that use it, from what I can tell, are complete idiots. Because they see, like, this connection going out, and they just automatically assume that they know what it's for. And the worst part is that if they had any like sense at all and were competent and knew what they were doing, that you can look and actually see
what the
connection's for, and you can actually watch the transaction. It's like this other guy on Macintosh I got into it with over this.
I didn't know you were participating in this. I thought you were just reading through.
Of course I am. I can't keep my mouth shut. Someone's wrong on the internet. They're gonna get told. So this guy was saying that there's the. I got on the Macintosh thing. This really tweaked me because he was saying that when you connect to iCloud, that there is a security token, like a private key, that you are sending to Apple. And first of all, that doesn't happen at all. Hmm. And secondly, there's any number of ways that you can see this for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But the most irritating thing about it was that when I said, if you look in your keychain and you can see the private certificate key and the public key that is created by iCloud and installed in your keychain, his response was, well, I don't even have an iCloud account. Are you sure that the thing in your keychain isn't the password? And I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure, because I actually bothered to set up the service so that I wouldn't be talking out of my ass. And I was able to like go in and double click it, and I could see exactly what it was.
Right.
So like the whole thing with iCloud is that when you have a computer, and then why are you doing this to me? you stuck a quarter in me.
There are a lot of people wrong on the internet, and they're going to get told. Yep,
there are a lot of people wrong on the internet. So the entire conversation essentially was him saying, well, you know, if you don't pass this password or this token to Apple entirely, then how could you log into iCloud without a Mac? And I'm like, you can't. You can log into the iCloud website to read your email, mm-hmm. but it's not like that's what iCloud... Like, he doesn't even know what the service is. Like, he doesn't, you know, it's not really clear to him that there's a lot of other things going on with this. Because that's actually kind of clever, because when you have an OS X machine that you join up to iCloud and applications that are using iCloud as a storage mechanism or a permission, you know, you can actually store things like preferences and things mm-hmm. like that in it too. So like one of the things that went away with the MobileMe transition was that you used to be able to sync things like keychains and preferences, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that went away, and people were like, you know, well, that's weird. Like, why did they take that away? That was a really cool feature. And it's like, aha, it was a really cool feature, and it's still there. It's just done in a different way now. So there's this, you don't actually store your iCloud password on your Mac, which is great.
Yeah.
When you sign in for the first time, it like does like its little key check thing, and you send it a certificate, it signs it and sends it back, and then you use this authentication token as a way to authenticate. And even mail.app uses those credentials when it authenticates to the mail service for iCloud. And it's actually a really cool system. And like,
it's a much better way of doing it, because then if your computer itself is compromised,
yes,
it's not, you know, your password itself is not compromised.
Yeah. No, I mean, and to unlock the keychain, you have to have the valid credentials for the keychain. So yeah. it's very clever. I like it a lot. There are a lot of people, though, that apparently just have no idea and can't even be bothered to check. Because I'm like, you know, this is what burns me more than anything, is that it's not something that's, you know, super difficult to validate and verify before talking about it.
So do your research before posting on the internet, especially
right.
within Emery's eyesight.
That's really all I'm asking. It's not really too much to ask. And then on the other hand, I'm wrong all the time. So there's a lot of, you know, I've been wrong on the internet before.
I have as well.
Did you know that Barack Obama's not Kenyan?
You know, I had a notion. Yeah.
Yeah. No, anyway. I really got burnt about that starting last week with all the news about Mountain Lion. And there's a bunch of people there that are just like, I can't believe it. You know, this gatekeeper thing, you're not even going to be able to run a piece of software that you didn't buy from the Mac App Store. And it's like, no, there's absolutely no evidence to support that. Well, I don't want my Mac to become more like iOS. Well, okay, so what's the worst case scenario if your Mac becomes a little more like iOS? I mean, you have notifications. Like, that's the end of the world. And they're like, oh, you know, I'm a serious content creator. I can't use this toy operating system. I'm like, no one's asking you to. Like, you're not running iOS on your Mac. Like, I don't understand, like, why people are, like, completely losing their mind over this.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see how it develops, but I'm a little bit wary of Mountain Lion.
Oh, you're one of them.
Just a little bit.
You're sympathizing with the enemy?
Tiny bit. We'll see how it all shakes out. But I'm wary of taking things that work really well in an iOS environment and porting them to a, you know, laptop or desktop environment, because it doesn't always, the transition doesn't always work out. So that stuff has to be done carefully.
I agree. And there's one thing Apple has shown us these last 20 years is that they do all sorts of really crazy things that never work. They have a long and storied tradition of screwing things up.
All right. Well,
do you see my point?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
While you were arguing with Macintouch readers,
were you playing your Vita?
I was having a little fun with the PlayStation Vita. So I've had it for about a week now, and it has been generally pretty solid. It is, however, still not a device I can heartily recommend buying. But for what it does, it's pretty good at doing it. I'm not quite sure about, it's got this idea of sort of everything is an app, you know, like your friends list is an app, your trophies collection, like your achievements, that's an app. The settings is an app, you know, which is like makes sense from a system architecture point of view.
Quick question.
But, yeah.
We didn't talk about this last week. Is there, like, some sort of voice over IP SIP or Skype for the Vita?
Not yet. Okay. But I've definitely, I mean, you know, there are, you know, there's a Netflix app, there's a Twitter app. There's no reason why there shouldn't be, say, a Skype app or something like that. So, but it's, you know, so everything on there, all this built-in system stuff is also apps. And the way the multitasking works, you kind of have to launch into them, which actually takes a couple taps in order to access them. So something like, I mean, you know, I just want to check which friends are online right now. And it's kind of it's just that additional step that is not all that cumbersome, but just makes it feel like this really segmented experience, rather than this unified operating system that works, you know, that does all the things you want it to do, sort of, you know, together rather than in these separate little compartments. So anyway, and then, you know, the games themselves are fun. I've been playing a little Hot Shots Golf, which is always a good time. And you know, there's a lot of good PSP games actually that are out there and available for download on the PlayStation Network, and a lot of those work on the Vita. So I've actually been playing a bit of those as well, and it's been generally positive. And In addition to that, I've apparently had some free time this past week, free time that's about to disappear, and I managed to also watch the entire first season of Downton Abbey.
Oh, I'm so sick of hearing about this show.
It apparently has gotten extremely high ratings for a PBS show.
Isn't it like a period drama?
It's got a little of that in it. It is pre-World War I England.
It's like all the worst things about a holodeck episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation.
it's about an estate and the lord and lady and their family. It's interesting. There's this soap opera that's going on in between all the nobility, and then there's all the servants that are kind of just sitting there watching the soap opera and, you know, thinking it's kind of funny. Which is kind of a nice, you know, dichotomy there. But, yeah, I don't know. It's well done. I mean, it, you know, everything is, the cinematography is great. The acting is great. It's all well produced, and, you know, it's a PBS show. So kind of, or it's a, I guess it's a, it's like Masterpiece or whatever their, you know, special feature program is. But yeah, it's solid stuff. And
I have nothing to say about it.
Yeah, I didn't think you would. I just thought I'd throw it out there. Because you know what? If you're looking for some good period drama television, the
you
place to
I
go
bet
is Downton
that
Abbey.
Show?
What's that?
I bet friend of the show, John Duxta.
Yeah.
Is a fan of that show.
All right.
I'm dead serious. He liked, what was it? There was another show that had like a similar feel to it, I think, that he recommended that I couldn't handle more than like half an hour of.
Well, when we have him on to do another TV episode, we will have to compare notes on Downton.
Yeah, okay. I started watching Damages on Netflix.
Oh, really?
That's a good show.
I know nothing about Damages.
It's Glenn Close, and she plays an attorney.
Huh. Oh,
she's really mean.
Yeah, I think I have heard about that.
I think it's pretty good.
Huh. All right.
I'm kind of hooked on it. I've like blew through like season one in 2 days.
Yeah,
that's what I've been doing. Like you were asking me earlier, like, what have you been doing this last week? I've been watching Damages.
All right,
enraging a McIntosh.
And enraging a McIntosh. Yep, that's that is the life right there. All right. Well, in other news, this past week, this actually I was just reading an article on this morning. I think this is when this news broke. That there is this Google Glasses concept.
A couple days ago, yeah.
Yeah, that is apparently a thing that Google is working on. Where,
well, they had the Google Goggles thing.
Well, I think it is combined with Google Goggles. I think this is called Google Glasses. I'm not sure it's branded Google Goggles, but...
No, but I think Goggles is kind of like the technology preview for it.
Okay, yeah. I mean, you can download an app that does some of the stuff that will probably be in this device. But the idea is actually Google is presumably working on a pair of glasses that you can wear that project augmented reality on the things you're seeing. So you can walk up to someone and see you know, their website or their profile or whatever.
Or their, you know, nudie pics on Facebook.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Or everything that they have ever done is immediately presented to you as soon as you meet them at a party. Yeah.
I would like to apologize in advance to my family. And
yep.
And my wife who has stood by me.
it would be a really interesting shift in the way the world works if everyone wore these around all the time.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what the implementation actually bears out, because, you know, who knows? I mean, this thing is probably not going to work as well as similar things work in the movies, you know.
I think you'd be surprised, because, I mean, seriously, like, the Google Goggles stuff on the iPhone and on Android
works pretty well, yeah.
It's really, really good.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me one lick that whatever these glasses end up doing are going to be really, really solid.
Yeah. I mean, the other question is whether you can, you know, wear these around town without being laughed at. You know, is it going to be like the Segway, you know, or the Bluetooth headpiece?
So, hello, bipeds.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's nothing quite as cool and futuristic as a Bluetooth headset.
you've told me at some point I was railing on Bluetooth headsets, and you're like,
I use one sometimes. Like, yeah. It's not like I don't walk around doing it, because I always feel like a complete tool.
Right.
But
yeah.
Hands free. Like, I hate having like the phone in my shoulder.
Yeah. No, Bluetooth headsets are fine as long as you're not strolling down the street using one. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And in the car, the Volkswagen thing, like the phone rings and I hit a button and then I...
Oh, yeah.
I just talk into the air.
No, and in fact, in California, it is illegal to hold a phone, you know, not, you know, use a phone in non-hands-free mode, basically. So...
God, I got to get to California.
Yeah, so Bluetooth headsets. They can work in some situations. But anyway, I'm thinking Google Glasses... if they can make them look really cool in a subtle way, then that would potentially be something you could wear around in public. But
I think the ideal application for this is that they end up getting however they're like projecting it into the glass. Mm-hmm. I think eventually they're probably gonna license the technology. So like when you go buy a pair of glasses from, you know, Theo or Tag Heuer or Versace or whatever, like they're just gonna have like these optics are gonna be an optional thing.
Yeah, but it's gonna have a bunch of Versace apps on it that you can't get rid of.
Well, in the case of Versace, that's probably true. But you know, it's certainly. I mean, yeah, you know what? That's a good point. You know, if that's the case, if they do like partner with somebody to like make these, I almost guarantee. I will bet you $10. Of American money.
Okay.
That the first company that puts out a pair of these is Oakley.
Yeah, I could get behind that.
and they're going to be like mirrored shiny wraparound.
Yeah. See that glasses. Yeah, that would be unfortunate. That's what I'm talking about. They've got to make them cool in a subtle way. So.
Yeah, but I mean, as you know, I'm surprised that like the first thing that they don't deploy this in is like passenger windows in a car.
Well, I mean, that's been done. I mean, like that's not necessarily true. Passenger windows, but car, you know, heads-up displays in cars exist. I mean, you can buy cars that have them.
They don't, but they're not this good.
No,
they're not goggles good.
No. I mean, yeah, they're not overlaying like GPS data on the windshield. Not yet.
Yeah, it'd probably be. I mean, you think it's bad people talking on the phone, waiting until someone's like trying to install
a movie,
new app.
And yeah.
I started raging hard because there's an application on my iPhone that I used to use called Agenda.
Uh-huh.
It's like a replacement calendar, and I was on my way to a meeting, and I hit the agenda button, and instead of seeing my calendar, I got a goddamn advertisement for another application that they make. I was furious.
Yep. Yeah. Just as bad as are those things like, hey, rate this application.
Oh, what is the deal with that?
All one of those is going to do is make me rate it lower than I would otherwise. I mean,
yeah. Like, I love this piece of software. However,
yeah, it pops up this annoying message telling me to talk about it on the App Store. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, all right.
I'm not a happy person.
What? You're not a happy person?
No. What is wrong with me?
Well, you know, it is hard to be both an arbiter of good taste and a you know, generally enthusiastic person about everything, right?
You're right, and I am pretty great.
Yeah. All right. Well, so the point of this show is actually to tell you about how to back up your computer well, and also to give you a little bit of insight into one specific solution for doing backups.
Yeah, we did talk about storage a few shows ago, and that was really cool. But the one thing we kind of glossed over, didn't really talk a lot about, was backup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one thing to have, like, you know, redundant network available storage for your house or for your residence, small business, whatever. But you know, network attached storage and an array is not the same thing as having a backup. So there's a lot of options there. Historically, I mean, I'm from a time where people, you know, wrote floppies out and, like, you know, you backed up to floppies or to DAT or QuickAdy or some other tape format. I've seen, like, giant tape libraries that are used. I've worked with things like AIT, which was, like, another tape format. And software like Retrospect for the Mac. And on Unix, I mean, we had things like even just straight tar archives. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what TAR stands for, is tape archive.
There was a time where I backed up my entire hard drive to CDs.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah, that's a rough go, too. You know, the other day, I have a Blu-ray recorder in my hack, and I burned like a 20 gigabyte Blu-ray disc in 3.5 minutes.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
That's pretty amazing.
Oh, I was really impressed. But that's nothing compared to the power of ARC. So, I mean, there's been all these, like, different ways people have to, like, do network-based backups, and there's, like, you know, things like Sync and Carbon Copy Cloner, there's Time Machine. We should talk about Windows backup. Maybe that's something that you want to talk about sometime, maybe.
Sure,
I don't know.
Sure.
But there's the remote, quote-unquote, cloud backup stuff, though, is kind of receiving a lot of attention, and rightly so, because one of the most important things of having a reliable backup is that it's an offsite or otherwise not also burning down with the rest of your house.
Right.
Backup, you know, like it's one thing to have like a stack of CDs or DVDs in the closet or a hard drive that you archive to or whatever. But if you don't have some sort of plan for what happens when your NAS is stolen or your house burns down or whatever, it doesn't really do you a whole lot of good. So there's a lot of ways people have come up with to address this, but by far and away, in my opinion, the best option for Mac OS X is a piece of software called ARC from Haystack Software. And I know you and I both bought it. It's important to say, like, when we when we play the interview, it might sound like I'm very overly enthusiastic about how much I like the software. I assure you, it's because I am just a very satisfied customer. It wasn't, you know, it's not like a paid endorsement or anything like that, but there's a lot of things about ARC in particular that I think consumers should pay attention to and ask other providers and other services to do, especially in how on how they open up their formats and things like that. And that's, I mean, I do go into greater detail during the interview, but I think it's great, and I was really happy to have the conversation, and I think it's something that we should do more often. I think there's probably a lot of really cool things that we could talk about with people.
Yeah, definitely. So I think without any further ado, we want to present this interview to you. We'll be back after the interview's finished. But for the time being, this is Emery talking to Stefan. I forget how to pronounce his last name.
Stefan Reitzheimer.
Stefan Reitzheimer, the developer of ARC.
Hammer.
Take it away, past Emery.
Joining us now for a special segment is Stefan Reitzheimer from Haystack Software, and their website is www.haystacksoftware.com. And we're specifically going to be talking about software called ARC, which is $29 and works with Amazon's S3 storage platform for safe and secure and expensive backups. S3 costs an individual user is only going to be paying somewhere like 12.5 cents per gigabyte. And then that's for the first terabyte of data. And the more you store, the cheaper it gets. So this is definitely a very inexpensive service and a very inexpensive piece of software for letting you back up and archive all of your important stuff and keeping it out of the house. Welcome to the show, Stefan.
Hi, thanks.
So one of the greatest features, I think, about Arc is budgeting backups. And this is something that I've never seen before executed this way. A lot of sites have, or a lot of services have, with their online backup offering, they'll offer some way of saying, you know, this is how much stuff you have, but they never really let you calculate exactly what you're looking at, or they chunk the storage in bundles or, you know, bins. But in your case, you're able to say whatever the user's budget is, make that work.
Right. I was actually at a Cocoa Heads. It's a developer meetup for Mac developers and iOS developers way back 3 years ago when I was first doing this. And I gave a demo saying, you know, what? Here's my UI so far. Tell me why it's awful and I'll fix it. and somebody said, you should put a budget feature in. Like, that's a great idea.
It is a great idea.
Yeah, it wasn't my idea.
Well, it's also really well executed, too, because you can very easily calculate the storage cost in real time. Like, you hit the little button and it does its query, it looks like, and it checks with Amazon and says, okay, here's what we're looking at. I think that's fantastic. There's a lot of other really good things about Arc. If you can create different... First of all, you can back up multiple machines. If you have more than one computer, it's very easy to get all of that data backed up, and then you can also browse all of those backups independent of using that machine, which I think is fantastic. And you can use different credentials for them too. So if you have like a family, if you have like your partner or your kids or someone in your office, you can also give them credentials from the Amazon S3 Web Services widget, and they can also have their stuff showing up in a bucket that you can view. So you could still kind of restore their machine for them, which is good in a lot of cases.
Right, right. But they can pick their own encryption passwords, so they can't read my data.
Yeah, the other great thing about that, too, is that you can, in the case of like a family situation where you're sharing something, you can kind of take over that backup, right?
Yeah, that's mostly used if you're going to migrate to a new computer and you don't want to have to re-upload everything.
Yeah. I thought that was really clever.
Yeah.
Now, is that like, how does it match the contents of your machine with S3? Is it basically using some sort of like a table that it consults to say these are the same files? Or like, how quick does that go? I mean, if you don't have to upload everything, how does it learn? Is it just kind of taking your word for it?
Oh, no. When Arc backs up, it looks at each file and it calculates a hash, a SHA-1 hash, mm-hmm. which is basically for any given set of bits in a file, you get a unique number. So if you have an object that has that hash, then it's going to be the same set of bits. So what it'll do if you adopt the backup data from your old Mac, for instance, is it will go through each file that you're backing up, calculate the SHA-1 hash for it, see that an object with that SHA-1 hash is already in your S3 account, and then not upload it.
When you have these backups that are being done, it looks like, and I don't have it right in front of me, but it's doing them hourly, and then it stores daily, and then it stores weekly, and then monthly. Is that correct?
Yeah, it does the same thing as Time Machine. So it'll keep hourly backups for 24 hours, and then it'll sort of thin them out to daily backups for the past 2 weeks, and then it'll thin them out as they get older to weekly backups until you hit the budget.
It seems... It's so fantastic to look at because you can look at your and like backup history. Like if I go onto my MacBook Air and I open up Arc and I browse back, I mean, you can restore a file as it was weeks ago. It's essentially like having Time Machine backed by Amazon.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
that's the goal.
If there was a way, if there was like some sort of either via fuse or some method of like mounting it on the desktop, that would, you would not even know the difference.
Right.
I mean, it's really fantastic. I can't say enough nice things about it. Mainly, one of the biggest features of it is, Amazon does offer, so backing up just a little bit, one of the things that always kept me away from using online backup services were that I didn't know if I trusted the platform. And it wasn't necessarily that I didn't trust the platform or the company, but I didn't know what protections were in place from other people. So, I mean, you could make the argument that, Dropbox isn't safe because if you use Dropbox, then a Dropbox employee can look at your data. Well, obviously the real concern there is, you know, are you trying to protect yourself from miscreants or are you trying to protect yourself from Dropbox? You know, but yeah. In the case of S3, the entire architecture is designed to be very accessible. So they've recently, like within the last year, they started adding a method of doing some sort of encryption to encrypt the data at rest. But when you access it, it still has to decrypt it, obviously, to read it. So it wasn't something that was happening on the user end or what a developer might call in user space or in user land. But the ARC system, it encrypts the data using credentials that the user can supply and control, and then it stores that on S3. So you don't have to trust Amazon.
Right. Your encryption password never leaves your computer.
And that process is critical, I think, for people who really not only have to have, like, for business requirements, a certain level of assurance, but also just for end users, it's just good practice. I mean, it's the kind of thing that people should expect, I think, to be able to control that type of access to their own data. And I think it's brilliant that it's there. What methods or what can you tell me about ARC's encryption and how it works so that when a user is uploading their data, that you can, I mean, is there some guarantee or some check in place that the data is not only encrypted, but that it's hasn't been mangled or that the integrity of the data is still good?
Yes. So ARC will encrypt the data on the client side, on your computer, using your password, and then send that through SSL to S3. Mm-hmm. The S3 API has this MD5 hash feature.
Now you're talking about the secret key and the AWS. There's two sets of credentials when you have an application talk to S3, right?
There's a public key and a private key.
Okay.
So the private key is the thing that you should never give anyone.
Yep.
And the way that S3 authentication works is every time you make an S3 request or you put an object into your S3 account, you have to provide an authorization token header.
That's right.
And that gets generated using your S3 private key on the client side. So the ARC app generates this authorization header given the bytes that you're sending, your private key, and then you send the request and S3 validates that you generated the right authorization header, which means you have the right private key. So you don't actually send your private key. You just generate this thing. Yeah.
That's good. So when someone wants to restore a file, does ARC have a way of verifying that checksum on the remote file to know that it hasn't been mangled in some way?
Oh, so when you upload the file, ARC stores your stuff in what's called a content addressable system. So the names of the objects in your S3 account are actually their SHA-1 hashes.
Oh.
So it deduplicates that way. If you have 20 copies of the same file, it's only going to upload it once.
Oh, that's pretty clever.
Yeah. And when it sends it, it adds an MD5 checksum that Amazon will checksum the stuff you just sent and see if it has the same MD5 value just to make sure that it wasn't mangled in transit.
Mm.
When you restore it, you're asking for the object with that SHA-1 hash, and that's what you get.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, backing up a little bit to the security stuff.
Sure.
Compared to other applications, a lot of them, they use their own encryption password, or you can supply your encryption password, but you have to give it to them in order to restore your data.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that I wrote this thing in the first place, is I couldn't find something that seemed, you know, reasonable.
Well, it certainly raises the standard. I mean, the one of the best things about ARC is this notion that you can kind of control that yourself, right?
Yeah, the thing is that once you go to the cloud, it feels like it's out of your control.
Yeah.
For, you know, when you're backing up to your time capsule in your living room or whatever, you haven't sort of handed off your data to anybody.
Yeah.
And once you go to any of these cloud backup options, you're handing off your data to somebody else, and that's kind of scary. So it really needs to be encrypted before you hand it off. And you should be able to get the encrypted stuff back from the person you handed it off from and then decrypt it yourself. Whereas, so like a friend of mine uses Backblaze and he had to restore his whole Drobo, I guess, and they sent him a hard drive. But they decrypted all his stuff and put it on the hard drive and sent it to him. So like all his stuff came unencrypted through the US mail, which was a little concerning.
Yeah, what's the point of encrypting it at that point?
Right. So yeah, you can pick your own encryption password, but if you want to restore, you have to go to their website, type in your encryption password, and then they decrypt it and put it on their server for you to download.
That's I didn't know that. Yeah. Only a couple of offerings where you have some sort of option for that. And as far as I know, the other one being Spider Oak is a service unto itself. I mean, like they have their own storage backend, they have their own software. And I don't know the particulars of how that service works, but there's definitely the one benefit to that is that it's a storage service. It's kind of like a Dropbox. You can synchronize folders and things, but again, it's another party. Whereas that, you know, I don't know anything about their financials or anything. Whereas with Amazon, I have a higher degree of confidence that, you know, those S3 storage units are going to be around for a while.
Right. That's the other thing about backup is that it's more important than, you know, photo sharing or something. It's kind of, it's backup. It needs to be really reliable. And I used to tell people you should tell your kids not to grow up to write backup software because it can be very stressful. Standard for reliability is much, much higher.
Yeah, people often, I mean, the security is a very multifaceted issue. I mean, it's not just a matter of protecting data. It's also guaranteed availability. It's being able to assure the integrity of the data. That's something that's hard to figure out. And I mean, a service like S3 takes care of a lot of that for you. And it's, I mean, that's definitely good. I mean, the other offering, I mean, did you look at other storage options, like, you know, the Rackspace option or any other vendor like that?
When I started this thing, it was beginning of 2009, and I don't think Rackspace Cloud Storage was out yet. Mm-hmm. But S3 was kind of the only game in town.
And they've made significant enhancements as they've gone too, which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things about this is that I routinely on this show and anywhere where, you know, anyone will listen to me, street corners, parks. I yell about proprietary formats all the time. And, it's not just proprietary formats. It's putting stuff that's important to you. You should never be putting it somewhere where you can't get it out without help.
Right.
So having these, you know, and the biggest, this was really obvious during the Lion launch. Like coming up on Lion, there are people that were just flipping out about Rosetta because they have a 7-year-old application that was left on the side of the road that they can't get anything out of, and it only runs on PowerPC Max. And they were screwed, you know, and they were really upset, and they should be because they made a critical error, and that is they've put their stuff into a format that they can't get out. And it should never happen with backup. And it is absolutely critical that people can get access to that. And you've taken a unique approach to this where you've released tools to recover the data from S3 is it public domain or what's the licensing on that?
Yeah, it's a BSD style license. You can do whatever you want with that code, I think.
And you've put it on GitHub so that even if Arc doesn't work tomorrow and you get hit by a bus and there are no bug fixes coming, God forbid, Stefan, I'm sorry to say that, but the user will be able to run this script on GitHub and recover all of their data that they've archived with Arc.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you'll have the Arc application, and once you download it, it doesn't make any requests. It has no dependency on my server or anything. So if my server goes down or I disappear, mm-hmm. The Arc application itself will work just fine.
Sure.
But there's also the open source command line thing if the Arc application has a problem. And the data format itself is written up in a big text file.
I think
so. There's a couple people trying to write. One guy's writing a Smalltalk library to read your Arc backups. I keep hoping somebody will write an iPhone app, but so I guess I'm going to.
Oh well, I mean, it's that would be actually really cool. Like to be able to do browsing of what is archived, or what do you envision there?
Yeah, just browse what's there, download a file, view it, email it to somebody, stuff like that.
Oh, that's really cool. That's a good idea. Huh. So the biggest benefit here, though, is that it lets a user maintain and validate control over their own stuff and their own digital destiny, if you will. So, right. I mean, is there anything that you think users should be asking vendors for? I mean, obviously we've got backup covered, but when it comes to other things, like, is there, is it a cultural thing, do you think? I mean, how do users encourage developers, to kind of open up a little bit in a way that doesn't threaten their business or isn't as, disruptive as they think it might be? I mean, do you have any advice for other developers maybe, or even consumers on how to expect that?
I guess I think all these things should have some sort of backup feature. Like a friend of mine writes an app called CloudPull that backs up your Google Docs stuff to your computer. It's like reverse backup because the official version's in the cloud.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, or like Path. You know, my wife and I stopped using Path after we got freaked out a couple weeks ago. And then I realized, oh, wow, all that stuff is unavailable to me now.
Yeah.
All those photos and things that I put in there, gone.
Have you looked at, kind of on a side note, did you look at the Adios package?
No.
There's a, it's called Adios. We talked about it briefly on our show last week, but you can find it just Googling Adios iOS, I think. It essentially packages up like a man-in-the-middle web proxy so that you can watch all of the applications that are transferring your address books to people.
Oh, nice.
It's a bit of an eye opener and a little depressing, but
yeah.
It's well worth it. But
yeah,
it definitely the Path issue raised and shined a light on something that's pretty important there.
Yeah, but you can't get that stuff out.
Yeah,
some sort of export feature, you know, create web pages from it or something so that it's around, because it's not like, you know, before computers we had paper and it took effort to destroy the paper so mm-hmm. to stay around, and it degraded pretty well. Paper, you know, stacked up, it lasts a long time. But with everything digital, you know, computers don't version anything. That's why I think one of the biggest features for me with Arc is the version backup, because every time you save a file, the old ones just gets obliterated, the old version.
What do you think of Apple's implementation of versions at the file system like that? I mean, do you see any enhancements that they could make with that?
Well,
I mean, obviously, I think the way that Arc does it is arguably better. I mean, you have a much longer history, and you have it somewhere where it's it can't be removed. Whereas the local versions in Lion, if you edit a file and you have versions of it, it's still local, right?
Yeah, and it only works with App Store apps, and it only works with apps that have integrated the version feature.
Right.
I think it only works with App Store apps. Whereas Arc, you know, works with any file. Apple's trying to, I think they wish that no one ever found out what a file was, because there are no files on iOS. And now there are files on the computer, and if they could just get rid of that file concept, then they could, you know, it'd be a lot easier to control everything.
Well, I mean, do you remember when Microsoft was first working on Vista with the Longhorn builds, they had this WinFS concept?
Yeah.
That was, I mean, do you think that that's, I don't know why they pulled out of it. I don't have any, like, information on that. But, I mean, they abandoned it pretty early on. Like, the database file system concept didn't really gel for some reason. I mean.
Yeah, that sounded like it was just way too big. That was everything to everybody, that project.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is that those guys, you know, before NTFS, they wrote VMS, which had versioning.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah, every time you save a file in VMS, or by default, I think, it used to create a new version of it, so you could go back in time.
I think, when did I use VMS? I used, my first internet access that I had was like a dial-up account to the law library at a university, because you could just call the library and be like, yeah, I need an account. And then they would give you one over the phone, and you could dial up, and then you could use Gopher. And so... I never really, at the time, I probably wouldn't have even known what a file system was, but
right.
That's an interesting thing. I mean, being able to kind of roll back in time, though, across all of your machines that you have Arc on, is definitely preferable to relying on someone implementing that API or working in that service. So that's way cool. What are some of the features that you hear about from users that are requested the most often?
things to be added.
Essentially, are there any of these things that people ask for that you're thinking about implementing, or are there any really off the wall, why can't Arc restore stuff that hasn't been backed up? Has anyone ever asked you that?
A lot of people ask for other S3 services. I'm finding that more and more things have an S3 compatible API. I'm going to talk to a guy next week who runs a green data center, I guess, called Green Cloud, that has an S3 API. And so people would like to sort of back up to things other than S3. My original goal with the thing was just to make it as simple as possible. So, I mean, you don't even have to give a bucket name in S3 for Arc. Hmm. It just generates one because then you don't have to learn what buckets are.
Yeah.
And you don't have to come up with a name that's unique, because S3 bucket names, believe it or not, have to be unique across all of S3's customers.
They're global unique. Yep.
Yeah. So instead of having to put that cognitive load on the user to have to understand what a bucket is, figure out a name that's unique, figure out some sort of naming convention, I just generate it.
That's a really good point. I mean, there is a learning curve for this that I don't know that Amazon really cares. I mean, the S3 service, I don't know that it's, designed to be. I mean, it's a developer service. It's not really something that end users do. Yeah.
The website's awful for end users. It's very hard to read. The pricing thing. I do get a lot of emails. What is this really going to cost me? Because there's all this per request pricing and stuff. And I just say, I back up 270 gigabytes of stuff and I pay less than $1 a month in the per request stuff.
Yeah.
I just mostly pay for storage, and the data transfer in is free. But it was not free for a while, and then became free again. So it's a little confusing.
Yeah, it's such an interesting service, though, and I'm glad that it's there. And especially when people really do clever things to leverage it. I mean, otherwise, there's really not a whole lot you could have done with it. I mean, it's a good idea.
Yeah, it's just an API. They don't provide any software to do anything with it.
Yeah. And you talked earlier about a mobile client that you're kind of thinking about doing yourself if no one else will. Is that, what do you think are there a lot of people that are asking you for a way to view and send files from their Arc storage?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the first thing. Once you back up your stuff to the cloud, the next question you're going to ask is, so why can't I access it from wherever? It's in the cloud.
Is there a slippery slope problem here, though, where people are like, well, I want to, because since you're able to retrieve files from any point in time,
why can't I sync it to my next?
Yeah,
that's a big request. The problem is S3 does not provide a locking mechanism of any kind.
Oh,
it's very hard to synchronize without a locking mechanism.
Yeah.
So you'd need a server in the middle, and then, before you know it, your Dropbox.
Yeah, that's true. But so, I mean, I guess the other part of this, though, is that you would be able to send the file to somebody. If the whole point was just to retrieve it to pass it along and not edit it and then push your edits back out.
Right. And people do use it sort of as sync. They'll be backing up their home machine, and then whenever they need files at work, they just fire up Arc and grab the file from their home machine's backup. Hmm. And I would like to do the mobile app. I try to not promise anything until it's actually shipping.
I think that's a good idea.
Things change all the time.
Yeah.
I do hope to do it. So maybe if I say that to you, then I'll feel more pressure to do it.
Now, kind of closing in a little bit here. I purchased Arc when it was offered at a discount from Mac Update, and I had a couple of questions about that process for you. I mean, when software gets sold as a bundle, or when they're kind of pitched as a sale item or something, is that a good deal for you? I mean, should I feel guilty, essentially, that I got a $10 discount on Arc?
You should never feel guilty. If it wasn't a good deal for me, I wouldn't do it.
All right.
But I mean, it's not really the revenue. It's more the it's a marketing exercise. Almost all my sales are word of mouth.
Oh, really?
So I don't buy any ad space or anything anywhere. It's just I figure if I ship a good enough product, people will tell their friends about it. There's no viral component to the app or anything, but people just say, tell their friends, hey, oh, you need backup? I use this and it's great.
So you're not going to be adding a little widget that talks to Facebook every time I back up a file to tell my friends that I just backed up a file?
I haven't gotten any requests for that.
Yeah, I think I really like the fact that you're definitely keeping an eye on user needs more than than your own, maybe.
I mean, it's something that I use every day, all day long, and I don't want it to be annoying.
Yeah. So I got to ask, is Arc available in the Mac App Store?
No.
Can you talk a little bit about why maybe that is?
There are a lot of rules to being in the Mac App Store.
Yeah.
And I don't think that I can meet them all.
Okay.
The one specific one that I can't meet is restoring your files with the correct permissions. So when you restore your files, if the files had different permissions than your UMask when you create a file on the computer, it gets some default set of permissions owned by you and readable by everybody and writable by you typically.
Mm-hmm.
When you're restoring files, Arc is really, really picky about restoring the files to exactly the way they were when they got backed up.
In fact, Arc is one of the few applications that also retains all metadata and Spotlight data when you back up and restore. That's a huge selling point.
Yeah, and at the time, most people didn't. And I actually got some emails and I got people tweeting things like my page that lists their awful backup bouncer results.
Yeah.
Tweeting those providers saying, when are you going to fix this? And they did. So I feel like that helped everybody, which I think is good.
That's a very good point.
A lot of those, like CrashPlan is doing much better, and a couple others. Mosey, I think, is doing better. Because nobody had ever really published tests of them before.
And to be fair, I mean, the backup bouncer package is not something that end users can really make good use of in a lot of cases. I mean, it does require, isn't it Python based? I mean, you have to kind of.
It's a little challenging to use, yeah. It's pretty geeky. But what was I going to say?
Well, the
Mac App Store. Yeah, so when you restore, if the file was owned by someone else, you know, if it was owned by root and you're restoring it, I can't make it root unless you give me root permission to do it. So what happens is Arc restores all the file data to your computer, and then it pops up this thing saying, I need your administrator account password, and then it goes and changes all those permissions to what they should be. And I can't do that if I'm in the Mac App Store. And I actually, I think I tweeted saying, you know, this is the problem. Should I get rid of this and put it on the Mac App Store, or should I not put it on the Mac App Store? And many, many people wrote back saying, yeah, don't break it just to put it on the Mac App Store.
Well, and I think the approach that one of the applications I use is Rubbernet, and they have, and it's like a network monitoring, session monitoring application.
Okay.
And what they do, they did the same, and Barebones had the same problem with BBEdit because they can't ship a CLI tool, but they have a separate package. So like after you buy Rubbernet, then you can, the first time you launch it, you have to go download a daemon from their website that can, it's essentially like opens LSOF, which lets you, I mean, well, you know, but listeners, it basically lets you monitor the status of all open files, pipes and sockets on your computer so that you can see all of that in this GUI. And I think the Mac App Store, you can't have an application that does that, but you can have like a separate helper that it talks to. And I think, and while that's great in some ways that you can do it that way, it's also a hassle because when you install the software from the Mac App Store, then you also have to go back and install this daemon and you might forget. And it does make it less friendly, I think.
Right. And the other problem I had, so my other two apps were on the Mac App Store for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Sync Photos is a thing that syncs photos between Macs. So like any photo in an iPhoto library in another computer, you can set it up to actually automatically. My wife and I if one of us gets new photos, plugs in the camera or whatever, and we're both on the same LAN, I'll automatically get those photos imported into iPhoto or vice versa.
That's great.
And the other one is DupliFinder, which just finds duplicate photos in your iPhoto library. And I had both of those on the Mac App Store. And it was really hard to provide decent customer service somehow. Like, because they're not buying from me. They're buying from Apple. Mm-hmm. Apple's got a no-refund policy. When they have a problem, they seem to have a really low expectation of support.
Yeah.
To be honest. Like, they think that I don't know. They thought I was some fly-by-night operation or something, or they just didn't think. I got a lot of emails. Or when I would get emails and respond to them, I would get a lot of times an email back saying, "Wow, I didn't think anybody would respond. Thanks." I try to respond like same day.
Yeah.
And help people. You know, I do this to help people. And it seems like people don't really didn't have that expectation in the Mac App Store, which just didn't feel right.
Yeah, and there's also the issue where, you know, if someone does have a problem, they'll, you know, leave the one-star review and be like, "That doesn't work on the developer release of Mountain Lion," and give you one star and like, "This sucks." And,
you know, well, it's worse than that. There will be factually incorrect comments written in the reviews, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, that's pretty rough.
It's like someone graffitied the box that you sell your software in, and you can't change it, even though it's the box that you sell your software in.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, certainly something to be mindful of when engaging in the Mac App Store. I mean, there's a lot of things that I think it does well, but there's certainly some things it doesn't. The fact that people are kind of expecting less is probably not what people want to hear, especially in the support arena. That's pretty rough. What were the names again of the iPhoto Sync tool and Dupe Finder?
Oh, the Sync tool is called Sync Photos. Mm-hmm. And the duplicate finder is called DupliFinder.
And those are also at haystacksoftware.com?
Yep.
All right. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks. Likewise.
I think Arc is fantastic software, and I hope a lot of people buy it. And it's going to save your life someday, I think, if you have it. So, again, I really appreciate you coming on the show to talk to us. And,
oh, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Thanks for writing Arc.
All right.
All right, and we're back in the present tense. Emery, we just heard the interview, you and Stefan talking about Arc.
Yeah.
Any sort of final wrap-up thoughts here you wanna present about Arc or about backups in general?
No, I mean, my favorite point throughout this entire discussion is that he's a developer that is not threatened by people being able to get access to their own data, you know?
Right.
And like that standard, I think, is something that doesn't get held up very often. I mean, there's a lot of people who keep their stuff in these proprietary formats that they can't get anything out of. And that really concerns me. And there's some interesting things going on with this. Like Stefan was saying, there are people that are working on like S3 compatible APIs for other services. So if you have an application that's written to use S3 for your storage backend, then you would be able to use another provider. So if for some inexplicable reason Amazon's gone from the internet tomorrow, like you would still be able to use the software with somebody else.
Right.
And those types of like standardizations and that type of environment, I think is really a positive one for consumers. And I think that it gives people some incentive to not only use those services, but also to come up with their own. And I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. All right. Well, you know, as Emery said, we are both happy customers of Arc, and I've just played around with it a bit. Definitely if it sounded good to you, do go check it out. It was on sale a couple weeks ago. Maybe, you know, I don't know if it'll be on sale again, but, it's, you know, probably worth it at full price as well. So,
yep.
Do check that out. There is a link in the show notes to the Arc website. And I think with that, we are done for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at show@hellyeah.com. You can visit our website at show.hellyeah.com.
Or on the Twitter machine, you may send us a tweet at Hell Yeah Show, twitter.com/HellYeahShow.
And that'll do it. We will see you next week.